The topic for today is Alternative Futures, a Christian Response. And for the record, I'm Mark Lund, and I teach economics at Luther College. What I want to do today is, I look forward to planning this session because I've been here now for 3 weeks, just about. This is the last presentation I'll give of the 3 weeks, and so I've had a chance to sit down and do some reflecting, try and tie some things together. And what this is really going to become is, in many ways, similar to a program that we used to have at Luther College. The freshman men at Luther College used to have what they called the last lecture series, where they would let faculty members and administrators come in, and give them 1 hour, and they say, "You have 1 hour to tell us what you think is really important and where you stand. Assume it's the last lecture you'll ever give in your life." Well, I'm trying to keep the topic to economics, so it may not be what I would give for a last lecture, but if I was giving an economics lecture, this would probably be the last one I'd give. So the issues I'm dealing with today are extremely important to me. There's a tough struggle at times working with these, but these are some issues that I think are extremely important, so I'm going to try and tie together a lot of things today. To begin with, what I want to do is look at 5 alternative futures. There's a book. I'm supposed to be talking about books here because they have a good bookstore and we want to let people know what's available. This happens to be a book that is not well known. It's called Seeing Alternatives by James Robertson from Great Britain. And the rights to the book, very popular in England and very popular in the continent, but the rights are bought by a small group in St. Paul, Minnesota. And for that reason, the book really hasn't gotten much publicity and hasn't gotten out. But I'm looking at 5 alternatives that James Robertson talks about. And so what I'd like to do is just briefly explain what these 5 alternatives look like, give you a chance maybe to discuss the 5, and then I will get into my personal thoughts and views, where I'm coming from, and that's where it becomes sort of like my last lecture, my last stand. I get one shot at it. So the first one, what might the future hold for us? What's it going to look like? First one is business as usual. By the way, you might think as I go through these, how you feel about each of the scenarios. You might think, which do you prefer? Think about that before I get into my my analysis of them. First one is business as usual. In this situation, they say the future will look like this. It'll be much like the present and the past. We will continue to have crises, similar problems, not going to change dramatically, and that the methods for handling the problems will not be much different from those in the past. We use changing economics, at least in my case, the monetary theory. Attitudes won't change much. We'll operate as nation states, and economics will stress material goods as opposed to services moving in other directions. That socially, we'll have professionals take care of the problems. The human problems as opposed to individuals doing that. And, it's not many people write about it. Business as usual. We just continue as we have for the last several, I'll say, decades. I've also written on the board who what type of people tend to associate themselves with these scenarios. And in this case, it is people who are pragmatic, problem solvers, good operators, successful troubleshooters, moderate reformers, those who are content with their present position or the future prospects in the existing system for the status quo. So, in my position, really, economists are troubleshooters. We see small problems. We try to solve those. You could put a lot of economists into this category. Also, it appeals to defeatists and cynics who are convinced that they can't change anything, so why worry about it? And let's just go on with business as usual. Suppose that's eat, drink, and be merry. And let's just continue on. Well, no, that might be number 2. The second scenario is disaster. It says that things are beginning to break down catastrophically. In fact, moral blindness is probably the greatest threat we have, a lack of compassion. And one of the books here for this summer is Matthew Fox's book on compassion. And I would say moral blindness means a lack of compassion. These people see no realistic alternative to nuclear war, famine, pollution, poverty, misery, disease, crime, etc.
The future looks terrible.
And we were talking earlier today about the nuclear arms buildup and where it's eventually going to lead to. The people in this category say that not much we can do. Disaster is inevitable. And so they're the pessimists and the hellfire doomsters and preachers. And so they'll talk a lot about it, but that's it. Everything's just going to pop. What can we really do about it? Then the third scenario is a totalitarian conservationist future. And here they say that disaster is inevitable. I mean, it's coming if we don't do anything. But we can step in and we can avert disaster by doing the following thing. We can accept an authoritarian system of government. And that authoritarian government can force changes in the area of conservation, cutting back on lifestyles, forcing sacrifices. History shows that people have turned to authority in times of chaos, and so we've got a historical precedence there. The problem here is the uncontrolled individual greed that we experience today is destroying the common good. And so we're going to have to do something about it. We can't do it on a voluntary basis, so let's give up some of our freedoms to some sovereign power, which will enforce law and order, and then distribute the limited resources fairly, and it will bring about the sacrifices that are needed. I talked about that the other day on inflation. Robert Heilbronner talks about this a lot. The disaster is coming, and we don't seem to be able to make the voluntary changes that are necessary. We may end up turning to some authoritarian type of government. I might add as an economist that any government that tries to run the economy and central planning has a very poor record in the area of efficiency. They do not do a very good job. Nonetheless, that's another example of what the future might be. The fourth scenario, well, who does the third one appeal to? It appeals to people who feel they have more to lose from the disorder or disaster than they do from authoritarian type of government. Also, it appeals to people who are dominating in temperament and authoritarian. And probably most importantly, it appeals to people who have a very low view of others. You can't change human nature. People aren't capable of finding the problems no matter how much you talk about them. And you have a very dim view or low view of people. And therefore, you say, we're going to have to go to some government to solve the problem. The fourth scenario is one where we want to break out of our present problems that we have by accelerating a super industrialist system like we have in the North. We want to make very effective use of science and technology. This is when we're going to break out of our problems with science and technology. So things like space colonization, nuclear power, computing, genetic engineering, all of these can help us overcome problems we have today, or some of the limits to resources, limits to energy, problems in biology, and at least in intelligence, we let the computers do a lot of the work. I read the other day that they're programming computers to think now. Is that right? So, I mean, that's part of where we're headed. Sort of the Star Trek future. This model says that growth, all countries can have a lot of additional growth, and even all the poor countries someday will have standards of living like we have. That's the point of view. This appeals to people who are very optimistic, energetic, ambitious, and competitive. There are people who like to stress the economic and technical side of development over the personal and social type of growth or human development. The fifth scenario is one that's called, and it's pretty obvious that the author has picked the fifth one just by the terms used there, but it's the sane, humane, ecological future. Here they say that it's not that growth is unimportant, but we're going to change the direction. That's what's so important. They're going to stress balance when it comes to economics and producing material goods. We want to be in harmony with nature. It stresses how we relate to other people. So the expansion will be mainly personal and social development, psychological development. We'll learn how to live in a very supportive way in a closed system, how to live with each other in this global community. Decentralization is important. The informal economy, about what Holden has, there's not much money that changes hands up here, but there's an awful lot of work. And a lot of things that are happening nonetheless. The informal economy becomes more important. This tends to appeal to people who are optimistic, who are very participative, and very reflective. Well, to summarize these five just quickly, Only one of the models says nothing about the future. And that's the first one. Business as usual. I mean, we just wake up, same thing today as we did in the past. Very little emphasis on the future. There's only one model that says catastrophe is inevitable. And that's the second one. The last three say catastrophe could happen, but there are things we can do to prevent it. We can look to the government. We can push economic growth, have all-out growth, or we can change our direction in what we determine, what we decide to be growth and human development. So the last three disagree on how you avert that disaster, but they're all concerned about it. The third and the fourth ones are both very elitist and rely heavily on central power as far as being decentralized, they don't emphasize that. The last one tends to be a little more egalitarian and decentralized. The last two are very optimistic about the future, that there's some hope. But the third and fifth one stress conservation, cutbacks, sacrifices. The fourth one looks at expansion. So just a brief overview. Now, before I move on to some of the things that I would like to really say or talk about in this alleged last lecture, before I do that, I'd like to give you a chance to make some comments, if you would like to, on this. And let me say before I just open it up for a few ideas or thoughts. Leaving the future in the hands of the experts, I think, is very dangerous. Experts are so specialized and so narrow that if we let everybody go their own little way and try and dictate what's going to happen in the future, I think everybody needs to be involved in that future. What will it look like? What do you want? How do you try and steer it and try and move in the direction you want to? So this is not an area just for experts to work in. That's one of the points of the whole book, is that we all need to be involved in it. Now, before I get into a lot of my own personal views, which will be extremely biased, I'll tell you how biased they're going to be, I'd like to just give you a chance to make some comments, if you'd like, on the five, anything you'd like to say about them. First of all, where do you think we are today? Where do you think we're going? Where do you think the Reagan economics fits into this scheme? Want to give it a shot? Okay, Reagan economics over here in four. Yeah. I think that my feeling is that there's a mixture of the two. And by the way, the future won't be one, two, three, four, or five. It's going to be some combination. But Reagan still uses many of the same old techniques. But there's much more emphasis on rapid growth. And so to put Reagan in four, simply to put him in four, I think would really be wrong. I mean, I don't think he has any idea that he's going to solve every problem and the whole world will develop to the level we're at and sees all of that potential. But he certainly moves towards four but includes a lot of the same things in one.
Are these supposed to be international, or just, are you referring to our United States?
Yeah, I'm referring to the United States right now.
But it's pretty difficult not to look at the disaster area, not looking at the international thing. Mm-hmm. Disaster for us could come anytime, but it's almost inevitable for the international thing to keep learning
and
practicing. But there will be a
pretty disaster. Yeah, I'll say a little bit later about how we fit in to the global setting in this context.
I'd be interested in how this is related to our agenda of what actually can we do individually and collectively. Things get very frustrating if they look at here's some different scenarios and this might happen or that might happen. But you can bring it down to some practical application, personal application.
Yeah, that's certainly my intention, that I move in that direction. And my last point, which will be 10, 15 minutes, deal specifically with that.
Yeah. Okay, given the nature of the human mind and the Western mind, that we're not going to stop the acceleration of technology and science or not, culture, like it or not. It's a part of all of it. The increasing use of computers and space exploration, and we probably haven't seen anything else. The fear and all those things. We're not going to stop. I'd like to see this rather combination going on.
Interesting. That's kind of the conclusion we came to when we did this the first week I was here. I mean, a lot of people talked about some combinations of 4 and 5, a mixture of the two. Yes?
You said with regard to 3, I think that everyone's going to try to control the economy of the business. Is that true? I think that only in our country, or is that true also in other countries, in the South or are there some cases in the English government who have to
Yeah. If you were to take the free enterprise system, and most of the characteristics of the free enterprise system existed, lots of buyers and sellers, good information, nobody, the economic power not too concentrated, no one has touched the free enterprise system for efficiency in producing goods and services. I won't say anything about human development, but in producing goods and services, no one's come close to it. And the Soviet Union, their economists admit that their inefficiency runs 25-30%. I mean, they could be 25-30% better if they were using the free enterprise system, but then you get some inequality or inequity, and they don't want that. I better not say that. Theoretically, that's not what they're after. And so the countries that have used central planning have all admitted that the free enterprise system works much better. Now, if you're comparing central planning to some other type of organization, it may be that that's better than other ways of organizing production. But no, it's the East Europeans, the Soviet Union, they've all admitted that central planning is not a very efficient way to run an economy. But you do control it far better, and maybe those trade-offs are worth it. You know, but as far as producing goods and using resources efficiently, can't touch the free enterprise system. And they admit it. I mean, that's not us in the West pointing our fingers at them.
That doesn't give a humanitarian. Central government, like that, is not a humanitarian.
No, you can't assume that it will be. And if that transition came in a short period of time, it would create havoc in our economic system. Our economic system works fairly well when there are small changes. It can make those adjustments. But when there are drastic changes, if tomorrow people stop buying cereals or whatever, people that would be out of work, and that just the whole transition would be just really almost unmanageable. And people will talk about number 5, and I'll be talking about that today, will say that that transition is going to be a slow transition. It's going to take time. We're gradually going to move in that direction. And just as we moved from feudalism to capitalism, it took a couple centuries to make that transition, this one will be slow too. And I think if it is a slower transition, unless everybody could change and feel good about it, and which isn't going to happen, I think it has to be a slow transition. And what we've got now is people that are already working in that area, experimenting, trying. And if gradually more may do that, maybe we will never see that shift in that direction. But if you're talking about a radical, fast change, it'd be devastating. For example, to solve the energy problem, a lot of people say, well, I'm just going to cut back on all of the styrofoam cups and all of these things that we buy that waste petroleum. Well, that sounds nice, but that creates jobs. And its output. And if you stop buying, you're going to really change the composition of the goods we produce, and some people will be out of jobs, you have to move them to new jobs, and all of that is extremely painful. So, I mean, drastic changes, I think is that what you're getting at, can be very destabilizing and can create enormous problems internally. It's crazy to say, oh, we'll just go to 5, because it won't be that easy, yes. Oh, sure. We change. I guess, yeah, when I say a century or so for the transition, I think that's just a change in attitudes. I don't know how fast they'll come. Maybe the economy can move faster. I'm talking about changes that come overnight, and like OPEC prices going up and what that ripple effect. It's hard for our system to handle it. I don't know how easy we move to sacrifices. I've been doing some thinking. I haven't done much work in this area yet, but that is when you cut back and you go to an economy that talks about less growth, what kind of psychological effects that has on the nation. I mean, we're here to grow, we're here to expand, the incentive is to make profit. Can you imagine going to a bank and saying, well, we want a loan because we're going to put on a new addition, whatever, or we have to replace some equipment, but we're going to cut back 20% in our production. You know, that would probably scare banks. And so, I mean, moving in the other direction is a little more difficult than expanding, I think. But you're right, it is amazing how fast we can change, say, in a person's lifetime, all the changes that could take place. Well, I want to go now to some of my own personal thoughts. And I guess I feel that some of these thoughts are really, they're pretty radical in that there aren't many economists talking about this at all. And I'll list one economist who I started reading in the late 60s and is no longer living, but it's E.F. Fritz Schumacher, Small is Beautiful. Really a good economist, good thinker. One of the first economists that stopped and said, say, maybe we ought to talk about our assumptions instead of just talking about what happens once we are given those assumptions. So what I have to say here is something that's been a struggle for me, especially a struggle because of the work that I do and the kind of teaching I do and the people that I meet. But here it goes. Our definition of economics. This is the one that's in most textbooks, is that we have unlimited wants, and we have limited resources. Now, what does that definition really mean? As far as unlimited wants go, we have an insatiable appetite for more and more. And I think our system does a fairly good job of promoting that. A lot of peer pressure, we think we need to accumulate. I think advertising gives you the impression that you need more. There's something called conspicuous consumption, where you buy just to set things out so that people know what you have. That was Thorsten Veblen, a good Norwegian economist from, I think, Northfield, Minnesota. And all of this emphasis then goes on the economic side, not so much in human growth, but development is seen as economic, accumulation of goods, and a lot of people refer to that as greed. And I know John Schramm and others here talk about this idea of growth appealing to the six deadly sins. I'm not an authority in that area to know exactly what all six of those are, but greed and being one of those. We've gone to a point where, in my classes, I talk about human capital. A human being is referred to as capital as a means in the production process, as opposed to an end. And so, with unlimited wants, what we're trying to do is produce as much as possible with our scarce resources, limited resources. And economists are efficiency experts. But we have unlimited wants. And we try, I mean, I don't know if you have unlimited wants, but most people feel that there's more. If I could say, would you be willing to stop buying now and just try and maintain what you have? And I don't know how many would say that. But our system, you tend to be known in our system by what you have, more so than who you really are. I mean, oh, they live in such and such a place, or they have such and such, as opposed to what kind of people they really are. Well, when it comes to limited resources, something that scares me a little bit is that even though our world is finite, I really don't believe a lot of economists and a lot of people have said that our resources are limited. Because we have land-grant institutions, and what's the purpose? New technologies, research and development, finding new resources, expanding what the resources that we can use. And so we haven't treated resources as really being limited. We're always trying to find more and more and more, and I don't think we've ever taken it very seriously. And yet we do have a finite world that we live in, and that's not knocking science and technology totally, but it's the mindset that we have is that really we're not too afraid about the resources being limited. At least we don't act that way, and even when prices go up, we don't seem to get too terribly excited. And we have these unlimited wants. What concerns me is that with this attitude of unlimited wants, we're always stressing growth. Economic growth is just progress. Terribly important. And we end up with some problems. And I've been talking about some of the problems that we run into because of this desire for growth. First one was inflation. The demand growing faster than the supply. People wanting more and more. And once inflation sets in, as we're finding out, a lot of the third world countries have always known this, very hard to produce goods and replace capital. When inflation rates are high, and we tend to buy even faster with high rising prices, more difficult to save and invest, and so, as we mentioned before, inflation feeds on itself. Then we have an energy problem, and where we're running out of some energy we've used, and we thought that with these renewable resources we could produce day and night, and we were no longer subject to when the sun came up and when it set. And what is our solution to the problem? We want economic growth. When we get the inflation, part of that, as I've said to many, I come from a generation that's very spoiled. I've never known a bad day in my life. I've always had food on the table, never had to worry about a job, never had to worry about any problem. My generation is really quite spoiled. And because of that, we want growth, and when we don't get it, we get some inflation. What is the answer that we're turning to again? Supply-side economics, and we're really moving into growth again as being the solution. Well, I could say a lot of things about, and I said it the other night, does this growth really bring human development and happiness? I mentioned that Roper poll, for those of you who are here. People say happiness is measured, it's in relative terms. If I'm getting more and you're not, I'm happy. But if I'm getting more and you're getting more, I really don't feel that much has even happened. It's a very relative thing for many people. So we're going to economic growth. And yesterday I talked about the benefits and costs of that economic growth. I think economists, many of us, need to spend much more time looking at some of those costs of growth. And then another problem is, growth has brought an inflationary problem. We're trying to solve it with more growth. Then we move to the international arena. And globally, the rich-poor gap is growing. The South tends to be quite dependent on the North. We're taking a good share of the world's resources. The South doesn't feel that it's getting a fair share. And in this whole process of growth, and we've had enormous growth in the North, and in certain areas, sectors, modern sectors of the South, we still have about 800 million people who in some ways have not had all their basic needs met. Food, clothing, shelter, a sound education so that they can function, and health. So, I mean, if growth has solved all of our problems, I mean, it doesn't appear that it has solved the problem, and yet we in the United States want to grow despite this wide gap between nations. Well, maybe it's unfair that I talk about economics in these terms. We have unlimited wants, most of us seem to, and growth is one of the ways to solve it. And economists are efficiency experts. With our scarce resources, we make sure we use them as wisely as possible. That's fine, good stewards. But it's always producing more and more and more. Now what I want to do is look at what I think is how responsible Christians should look at the future. And some of the ideas that I'm going to express here are ideas I've struggled with, but I've been able to sit in a couple sessions here the last couple of weeks that have really helped sharpen up some of the issues for me. And so what I have to say now in the next few minutes is radical gospel or radical biblical, a biblical consciousness. And I guess I can't, well, maybe I should say this before I go any further. You have to know where I'm coming from. I've spent not a lot of time, but considerable time, living with people who are really poor in the world. I've been in Tanzania and Kenya to see it, and in Egypt, but especially in Peru. And in Peru, I sometimes go for a couple weeks at a time into the mountain villages and live with those people, areas of that project, Lutheran World Federation, and live with them. And you have to realize my mindset is that I have lived with these people, and I've seen them all over. They're suffering because they don't have enough. And yet they have something in the social development, personal development that we have lost. And they teach me an awful lot, of course. But you have to remember that I've lived in those conditions and I see that. And so when I talk about the things I'm going to talk about now, that's where I'm coming from. It's probably a little different from where other people are coming from. There are a couple of statements I'd like to read here. First is that Robert Bella, who is sociologist, at least in Berkeley, sociology of religion, he said, we have to learn how to live responsibly in a revolutionary world. I mentioned that last night. He also said, we have to find out how we can live together in a just world community. So I'm really going to a global emphasis now, if you haven't picked that up yet. How do we live in community? We have to have some kind of dream, some kind of a vision. And the thing that really scares me is that I go through some of these that I'm going to call, using John Strand's terminology, biblical think with, for those of you who have heard that session, there's a tape on it. It'd be awful hard for me to explain a biblical think with, but it's the assumptions, it's the consciousness that runs through the Bible. It seems to be a major theme. Before I run through those, I just want to tell you why there seems to be such a problem for me, coming from where I am. White, male, middle class, United States, known as an institutional truth. We need a dream and a vision of a better society. And yet we Christians, who were originally a sect of the poor and the oppressed, I don't have a sound biblical history, but my impression was that the early church was poor people. In fact, they weren't even sure they wanted to let the rich or the wealthy in. They were afraid of it initially. Now, that's how we started. We soon, because of the historical development, soon we became the religion of the empire. And now we are really the status quo. To many, we are the oppressors. Now, how can we, a church who has become the status quo, talk about issues of freedom, liberation, equity, and justice for all? That's really tough to do. I can't tell you how tough that is. Not an easy issue that we're dealing with. Well, how can we dream? We're not the poor. We're not going to go down and do the work that the poor are going to do. It's just, Manzanelli, something like that, this morning talked about some of their struggles. They're going to be involved in this. But how do we look at economics, this idea of unlimited wants and growth? How do we try and work through that? It's a difficult task. Okay. Here are a couple ideas. I'm going to refer to three ideas. Larry Rasmussen, a couple weeks ago, talked about the Greek term oikos, O-I-K-U-S. That Greek term is the root word for economics, ecology, ecumenical. We talked about how important it is that we are in balance with nature and with people in the community. Because we've had a lot of good resources, especially the oil and the natural gas, we can use it day and night, and we've had an abundance of it in the past, we have sort of decided that we in economics would sort of overtake the environment and make things, we were going to be the planners and we were going to be in control. We've forgotten that we're subject to the environment. And we need to learn that. We need to be in balance. And economics, taking care of the household, and Matthew Fox talks about that, what is the home now? But taking care of that is a very important part of that is being in balance with the environment and with nature. I think we've forgotten all that to a great extent. And secondly, to be in harmony with other people. So that's the first thing. It was really helpful for me to hear Larry emphasize that point. Then I listened to John Strand talk about a session Biblical Think With, and he used, by the way, the Think With term is an E.F. Schumacher term. It says we don't just try and talk about problems, but we try to look at the assumptions that underlie how we think. And the term that John Strand used was sufficiency. He says that biblically there is a consciousness that runs throughout it that says those who have too little suffer, and those who try and accumulate too much can have problems. And sufficiency is the real theme that he wanted to stress in there. I carry that a little further. That has something to do with fitting in. How do you fit in to what's going on? And globally, and I took students overseas for interns. Great way to see and to feel what the problems are. And I had more students who were just sick being people from the United States living in those settings because they felt that they just didn't fit in. And part of fitting in is to be able to say to your neighbor that we're a part of you, we understand who you are, and we don't feel that we're way out of touch or way out of balance. And when these students just go, I'm just embarrassed to be from the United States, I didn't realize how rich I was, and I see what's going on, you begin to understand more about sufficiency. Not having enough is terrible, but having too much can be bad. The sufficiency and also enough is enough, fitting in, very important theme. Then another theme that I like to talk about, one that comes from a friend of mine who teaches at Augustana. And he talks about the biblical vision of shalom. That shalom is a vision. And he says that there are five dimensions. The first dimension, shalom is really a powerful term. It's really helped me to read this little two-page article. The first dimension is one of wholeness and harmony. Each part fits in. And again, when you look at where we are globally, how do we fit into that global setting? Are we a part of it, or do we stand out almost like a sore thumb? The second dimension is that shalom originates in God. And God was someone who was concerned about justice, the oppressed. He wanted to liberate the oppressed. And that's a very important theme, especially when you look at the problems globally. Third, shalom is a normative idea. It's a vision, a dream. It deals with the transformation of this world. It calls us to action. What could a better world look like? It means to minister wherever we find those who are oppressed, and poverty, discriminating against those who are suffering. Justice then is an indispensable part. And so as an economist, I tend to be far more concerned today about justice and fitting in than I am about growth. Fourth, did I do the fourth one? Yeah. Fifth one is that shalom is deeply rooted in the Jesus story. Jesus is at the heart of it. Jesus was an example for it. And there's something else that I learned here this last week, and it's really, really also very helpful. We talked about Easter here, the Easter message being something very scary. I hadn't thought about that before. Usually we think that Easter is good news, and it's a wonderful day, and the sun's shining, and we really feel good. But what the Easter story says is that what Jesus is talking about is really true, and that is scary, because the life of Jesus and the things that he taught are so different from the way I think many of us think nowadays. And so that's why around here, at least, they really celebrate Pentecost. Because I don't know the right term. I've been trying to pick their minds to figure out what the right term is. But it's not really the coming of the Holy Spirit, but it is a re-emphasis or a reminder of the power of the Holy Spirit. And you really need that, because the story of Jesus is really radical. I don't know what else to say. So this idea of oikos, fitting in, being in harmony, somehow either we've lost control. And I guess this morning in the Bible study we talked about possessions and how sometimes we lose control of what's going on. The idea of sufficiency, enough is enough, and also shalom. Those terms have then become so powerful that consciousness really is beginning to affect me as an economist. And so I'm going to talk about a little different definition of economics now. This is something that Schumacher talks about. He has a chapter in his book called Buddhist Economics. Strangely enough, having read him so much and having been around him a little bit, I never realized that he said that when he wrote this chapter on Buddhist economics, it's really a classic. Everybody talks about it and reads it. He said, I would have labeled it Christian economics, but I didn't think anybody would read it. So he put Buddhist economics on it, and he said you could change it, and it's amazing how many people read it, but he doesn't see many differences. Schumacher says this, some of my friends are starting to say this, and I think maybe a new definition of economics wouldn't be a bad one, but it's really radical, and it changes, it almost flip-flops things. Instead of saying that we have unlimited wants, we make the statement that we have limited wants. A matter of how do we fit in with our neighbors? How do we have respect for this earth? You have limited wants, and then you need economists because you want to find the most creative and efficient way to meet those wants. There's lots of room for good stewardship in this, but you're controlling your wants so that you do fit in. I find that to be a really challenging idea, and in our own life, my wife and I and our family, the children, what we try to do each year is make a list of the things that we think we need. The new addition. We work real hard at trying to figure out what we really think we need. And then we don't worry about anything else. I don't care what the neighbors buy. I don't care what my brother and sister buy. I don't care about what I hear on television. I just don't care about those things. I figure out basically what we think we need. In fact, our list now is almost complete. And we don't live in poverty. I don't want to mislead you to think that I'm a big noble saint or anything. But what we do is try to maintain as best we can what we do have. Well, that new definition of economics then is, I think, a fairly radical one. But as Schumacher says in his subtitle, Economics for People Matter, and I would add where nature matters, is to me becoming a very important concept. I would say that we here in the United States are probably a little overdeveloped economically. And I say that in context of the global, of all people, of being global citizens. And maybe in the context, for me personally, that when I look at the cost and benefits of growth, I think the cost is started to outweigh, for me personally, the benefits of growth. I mean, that's where I'm coming from. You can come from wherever you want. I mean, but that's how I feel about it. And for that reason, I like the idea of a new definition of economics, because to me and for our family, it tends to be a freeing experience. Freeing in that I'm freed up from that constant pressure of feeling that I've got to accumulate more and more, and it gives me more time to worry about other things in life, personal development, social relationships, things like this. I find that to be a lot more exciting, although I guess when you're raising a family, you still find that your time is somewhat limited in to how much you can work in this other area. A real concern to me, and that is, we live in a free enterprise system. When all the assumptions hold in the free enterprise system and you have a moral foundation, we talked about this the very first lecture, I still think the free enterprise system is an incredible invention. It's unbelievable how efficient it is, but it does tend to create inequality. And if there's one thing that bothers me about it, it's a quote that I read somewhere that one of the major things the free enterprise system does in democracy is it gives people the freedom to get ahead. And that term, get ahead, is becoming harder and harder for me to handle. Instead of fitting in, it tends to be getting ahead. And that is a concern for me today. It's a hard one to work with. What is a better system? Well, I have problems with that. But if we're going to use this system, I feel very uncomfortable when it promotes those kinds of things. Remember, you have to remember that kind of thing. What I'd like to say in the last few minutes, I'm finally going to get, I think, to answer your question and talk about some things that I think are positive. We're interested in what I call simpler lifestyle. And the simpler lifestyle, I would rather call responsible lifestyle. And because of my ideologies and whatever, I'd rather call it Christian, or responsible Christian lifestyle, to go one more step. And I think in many ways it relates to what's here on number five. Again, I don't want to throw the technology out of number four. There are certain places where technology, I think, plays a major role. But this idea of just expanding for the sake of expanding, I personally am feel very uncomfortable with it. But let me just refer to something quickly on lifestyle. There's a book, it's by James McGinnis. It's called Bread and Justice. It deals with international problems of hunger. And I told a lot of people about it last week when I dealt with international issues. And I think they've run out of it in the bookstore. But in the last chapter in this book, it has a Shaker Town pledge. And I forget which group made it, but they wrote it up. But you can see it in other places, the Shaker Town pledge. And I just want to run through it real quickly. I probably should have put it on another board and put it up if you can see it visually, being the book's out of print, or out of stock. But I think these things are important, and I want to elaborate on a few points. First of all, in the Shaker Town pledge, it says, we all want, the first objective is to be a world citizen. And that's really become important to me, probably because I travel and because I get to live with people in other countries. But I think that's essential. You have to start thinking more as a global citizen if you're really going to fit in Shalom and all of this seems to make any sense. Because if you take it in the context of the United States, I would say you probably, most of us probably fit in. So it's that global perspective. Secondly, we need to have some respect and harmony for the environment. Treat it with respect. And that was part of Larry Rasmussen's presentation. It's so good. We've gotten pretty confident that we can control it. There are limits. We've got to relearn that. Third, it stresses creative simplicity. And I'll say a little bit of our simpler lifestyle. Because it is creative, it's very difficult. Fourth, we need to reshape institutions and systems that promote justice. And that, I've said a little bit about that, not a lot, the new international economic order. When countries try to make changes, it tend to promote a more just lifestyle. We need to be supportive of that. Occupational accountability is a fifth one. Really a tough one in that system. Sixth, affirming the gift of your body. Good nutrition, good exercise, rest. Seven, examine continually the relationships you have with others. And that's where, if I'm trying to get everything in this last 50 minutes or whatever, for me, justice issues must begin at home. Until you understand justice issues right where you are, how you relate male, female, parent, child, student, teacher, rich, poor, whatever. Until you understand that at home, you might as well forget about even trying to understand it at the global level. You don't see those people. It's hard to make that extension. Eight, you need time for personal renewal, time for meditation, study, and prayer, some silence. Jesus certainly was a good example of taking time out. And that's been part of the Bible study too this week. Take time out to go to the wilderness. Time for reflection. And then ninth, you need responsible participation in some community of faith. That's where the faith plays an important role in communities, a support group. Well, let me say a little bit about a simpler lifestyle. A simpler lifestyle for me does mean consuming less. It does. And it's part of what is it that you feel you need. It does mean conserving. Being very careful about not wasting. It means sharing, when you can share it. I think John Tram talks a lot about those things in some of his books and some of his tapes. But some of my concerns about changes in lifestyle, I'm interested in acts of justice, but also changes in lifestyle. The first is why you get involved in it. And you should never get involved because of guilt. I think it's because there's a vision, a dream that you have, a better life for all people, and that you do it on a voluntary basis, you do it out of love, you do it because you want to do it. And if you do it for other reasons, you just not go anywhere and you're going to feel lousy and miserable. So it's a voluntary thing, and that's why this biblical consciousness for me is so important, to get some kind of a sense of how I feel. I'll say this real quickly. If I was Secretary of State and Secretary of Defense, some of you probably heard me say this before, what I would do is to solve the military problem, because I don't really believe in unilateral disarmament. I hate to say that, but I haven't been able to convince myself yet. As a Christian, I say, sure, I believe in it. But I haven't quite gotten that far up here. I would say, give everybody M16 and all the ammunition we need, and then try and let a country come in and take us. And they could blow us away if they wanted, but they wouldn't take us, because who knows Decor better than the people in Decor? But what I would do with the money I saved is send people in the United States to other countries and let them live there and bring some of them over here, and we just find out that we were all pretty good people, and we begin to feel how we fit in. Some of those things, the balance, I think, would become much clearer. Well, another point is that when you do make changes, they have to be right for you. Can't be forced. I mean, you just can't. Where you feel you've got skills and the changes that you can make, then you should work in that area. Also, I personally think, although others may think I'm not radical enough here, I think you have to move slowly. You just can't jump in too fast. I think that's one of the worst things you can do. It evolves. And one of my warnings is, don't think you're Superman or Superwoman, because it would be too frustrating. I mean, that's part of the moving slowly. One of the reasons why I like changes in lifestyles is that it becomes a daily process whereby acts of justice are very important. It's an everyday matter. And you think about that, and it gradually evolves into things that are bigger. But you're thinking about those things as you make the changes. And if you get internal changes through this daily struggle, it should deepen any sense of commitment you have, and which will hopefully lead to some action. And if you do get involved in changes in lifestyle, you'll probably come in contact with people who are oppressed and poor. And from them, you can learn a great deal about justice. It's a great learning experience, and you may ask. So that I think there are good reasons to get started in that area. Now, a bunch of little tips, and then I've got about 10 too, so I'm going to have to quit in just a couple minutes. First of all, a simpler lifestyle, going to number 5, has nothing to do with poverty and austerity, as far as I'm concerned. I'm not going to go out and live like a pauper. I mean, but it means I'm not going to consume and consume and consume and just go, way overboard in that direction. It's not a passing fad. It's a lifestyle. There are a lot of people around the world that are working on that. Lauren Halverson worked with Lutheran World Federation for a couple of years, studying communities, and he still does. And there are a lot of people around the world that have these concerns, especially in Europe. It is not a back to the land thing. Responsible lifestyles mean you have only 1 foot out, but you leave 1 foot in. And you're concerned about what's going on with the people around you and in politics or whatever. You do not withdraw. It is not isolation. It probably won't solve the world's problems immediately. I mean, it's not a cure-all. But I think it will get you, you'll be much more in touch with some of those problems. Now, here, those are some things that it isn't. It's not a solution to the world's problems, just like that. It's not poverty or austerity. It's not back to the land. Some things that it is. It's hard work. That's the thing that, we all know the cost of discipleship and all that. It's just hard work. There's no getting around it. It's risky. Really a risky thing. It's revolutionary. It requires a lot of commitment. It's human-oriented. Cooperation is very important. Working with others supports you. You're very conscious of injustice. I guess I've already mentioned that. It tends to be nonviolent. It usually begins at home. And some things that I really like about it is it's creative. If there's one thing that is really sad about the way we do things in the United States, is the way in which we stunt creativity. I'm a product of it. And it's really hard to break out of it. When you get in a place like Holden or wherever, and you watch people start to think and unleash the mind, it is fun to see what you can think of. Little stuff you can do. I've got a neighbor who's going to solve energy problems. So he's collected tin cans, and he's got his own solar collector. And really works. So last summer I started gathering mine. my cans and old storm windows, and I'm going to build my new summer. And just a little creativity, mean, the energy problem has brought all kinds of creativity on the part of many people. That's exciting. In fact, I should say something I haven't said yet. Those problems, you talk about disaster, a lot of people say, oh, the curse of the energy problem, oh, the curse of inflation, oh, the curse of the growing gap between the rich and the poor. I see it a lot different. I don't want to call it a blessing, straight out blessing, but it's causing us, I think, to re-examine what we've done in the past. And I think many good things could come out of it. I would see it as a positive challenge, something that I take on as something that's exciting, a lot of room for creativity. Let's see. Community is very important also to a change in lifestyle. Well, in this five too, I can't go any longer. But if you, it's kind of fun to get some of these things out. I might add one final point, and that is Matthew Fox, who wrote the book on compassion, as far as I'm concerned, has written just an excellent book. What we really seem to be lacking is compassion, where we care enough about other people to find out what the problems are and then act on it. And in our system, we have gotten so caught up in growth and maintaining that, and some of the things I said before, how much we earn and how we spend it and how we maintain it, that we haven't had the time to perfect that. We've lost it. And so I'm interested in justice and compassion, and I just want to fit in. I want to be a part of God's creation that respects the environment, one that respects other people.